Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You hear this phrase in politics all the time, plausible deniability. Turns out, works pretty well in business, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 25th of April. Good to have you with us. The death toll in that garment factory collapse in Bangladesh is now above 230 people. Thousands more, possibly, are still trapped in the rubble. It's the second such disaster in less than 6 months in Bangladesh. A fire in another factory back in November killed 112 people. Both factories are thought to have produced clothes for American retailers, and each tragedy brought pledges to improve worker safety over there. But with layer after layer of contractors and subcontractors between multinational headquarters and the person actually doing the stitching on the ground, how do you know who's responsible? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more now on plausible deniability as a business strategy.
After cracks were discovered in the now collapsed building, managers at a bank on the first floor kept their employees out. Managers in the garment factories ordered their employees to stay.
It's worth thinking about the psychology that would cause factory managers and owners to send workers back into a building that has developed an obvious dangerous structural flaw.
Scott Nova is head of the Workers' Rights Consortium, and he says it's all about competition. Large apparel companies have multiple contractors in a place like Bangladesh. Each of those contractors hires subcontractors and then sometimes more subcontractors, all of them competing against one another. Nova argues apparel retailers use this structure to lower both price and accountability.
That guarantees that they will cut costs by operating unsafely, but without Walmart's or Gap's or H&M's fingerprints actually having to be on it.
Jan Hammond is a professor at Harvard Business School. She says retailers have to contract with many different factories in order to meet demand.
But it doesn't mean that you can't inspect those companies.
Bigger brand-conscious companies like Walmart have started auditing factories that produce for them. After a deadly fire, also in Bangladesh, Walmart announced it would permanently ban any supplier found to be subcontracting without its permission. Hammond says smaller, private label retailers are less aggressive and may not even know what's going on.
It's not as clear to me whether it's intentional or not to not know.
Ultimately, pressure for this cutthroat competition, economists say, comes from the consumer who wants that cheap T-shirt. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Consumer loans are arguably the lifeblood of the American economy. They help us buy everything from homes to autos and appliances. And then there are guns. A lot of gun buyers prefer to pay cash. But for those who can't, there's a finance industry to help out. Some of the big names are leaving that now politically sensitive market, GE Capital, General Electric's finance arm most recently. So we asked Marketplace's Sally Herships to explain gun credit.
Say you're in the market for a gun. First of all, how much does it cost?
Well, the average gun is about $500. There's some, of course, less and some a lot more, but I would say the average is $500.
Larry Hyatt owns the Hyatt Gun Shop in Charlotte, North Carolina. He sells guns, and a lot of Americans are buying. Last year, $6 billion of firearms and ammunition were sold at retail. That's up almost $2 billion from the year before.
A lot of used guns, collector guns, law enforcement, hunting.
Like a lot of gun shops, Hyatt's store offered credit for customers that needed it. But then when the financial crisis hit,
The company that did ours quit doing it. They would not do guns anymore.
Hyatt says the loan company was owned by AIG. Now he offers layaway for his customers. But he says most pay with plastic or cash.
Thank goodness the credit card industry came to the rescue, and that's gun financing. It's just through the normal credit card, not through a separate company.
But what about consumers who can't qualify for a credit card? Randy Frazier owns gunfinancing.com.
What we're after is the client that's trying to buy a gun that he can't afford to pay cash for.
Frazier says his website's customers are typically 21 to 32.
I won't say they're not perfect credit, but they're not poor credit. They're right in the middle.
He says if you are going to finance your gun, expect to pay about 18% in interest. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Wall Street was a near perfect arc today, gently climbing higher, then slowly settling back down to earth. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are about 5 million people in California who don't have health insurance. You'd think they'd be counting down the days until Obamacare goes fully into effect, especially the part about health insurance exchanges, where the uninsured could go to buy themselves some coverage. But poll after poll out here shows most people know little about Obamacare in general and the exchanges in particular, and those that do know don't understand them. That's a lot of ground to cover. So California is banking on a big marketing blitz. From KQED in San Francisco, Arthi Shahani has more.
It's 7:30 in the morning at the Lifelong Clinic in West Berkeley. A construction crew is banging on some walls when Layla Herbert Gray walks in with her mom.
My ear hurts.
When did it start hurting?
5 days ago.
The six-year-old buries her head into her mom, Tanisha Herbert's sweater.
I've been trying to give her Tylenol to, you know, numb the pain some, but it's not working.
Does she have health care coverage?
No, I had health care coverage through my job, but I got rid of it because it's so high. So hopefully she can be seen today. That's what's been taking so long.
What's been taking so long?
Well, as far as me getting her an appointment, because I don't have the insurance to cover it.
When health reform kicks in, Herbert may be eligible for tax breaks that make it easier to afford insurance, something she didn't know until just now.
We are targeting about 5.3 million Californians. That's who our marketing efforts are targeted to.
Peter Lee is the director of Covered California, the state's health insurance exchange.
The marketing campaign is going to be well over $150 million. It's a big spend, but we are a very big state.
It's actually a much bigger spend. About $150 million is just for TV ads and traditional media buys. Covered California is putting another $150 million or so into social media, data mining, and boots-on-the-ground outreach.
It's the biggest change since Medicare.
And it's a huge challenge. According to a recent poll, 90% of Americans don't know the new insurance exchanges will open this fall. About 1 million of those eligible in California don't speak English well. So some call centers will need to handle a dozen languages, from Armenian to Tagalog. Another challenge? Most of the uninsured are healthy. They don't need a doctor this minute. Obamacare needs them to subsidize the cost of covering the sick.
When we open our doors, that woman with breast cancer who's been denied coverage, she's going to find us. She's going to get in the door.
But that healthy woman who doesn't make a lot of money, she won't jump at the chance to pay for coverage. Covered California is getting help from the state's largest health foundation. The California Endowment is putting more than $200 million into the pot. Vice President Daniel Zingali says the government can't do it alone.
There's still a lot of confusion. Even people who say they think it's probably a good thing are surprised when they find out they may be eligible.
Does that mean everyone?
Does everyone include me?
Us too?
About 3 or 4 million immigrants, most with legal status, some without, are not eligible. The endowment created this video urging the state to change that by keeping county-run programs open and expanding Medicaid on the government's dime. Zingali says it makes sense to have as many options as possible for uninsured families, like Tanisha Herbert and her daughter Layla. Back at the Lifelong Clinic, intake worker Cynthia Gonzalez helps Herbert apply for Medicaid.
So go ahead and print her name and then sign. If it's not approved, then that means that you will be stuck with the bill.
I'm liable for the charges, yes. Mm-hmm.
Today, Herbert decides not to worry about it. Her daughter needs a doctor. In San Francisco, I'm Arthi Shahani for Marketplace.
President Obama is going to Mexico next week. There will be talks with that country's new president, Enrique Peña Nieto, on a whole bunch of things. Immigration, drug cartels, the boom and bust economy down there. But in her new book, it's called Two Nations Indivisible, Shannon O'Neill says a big chunk of American prosperity depends on what happens south of the border. Shannon, it's good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So the gist of this book, if I read it the right way, is that our relationship, the relationship the United States and Mexico have, has changed immensely, and yet the policy makers, specifically in Washington, just haven't caught up yet.
You look at Mexico, and no other country is as important to us today as Mexico. So for the food on our tables, to the parts in our cars, to the consumers for our products, to the drugs on our streets, Mexico affects us every day, our everyday lives here in the United States.
So why isn't Washington paying closer attention? I mean, the only thing you hear coming out of Washington about Mexico is immigration, 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 and then immigration.
There's been many changes over the last couple of decades, but most of them have been quite good changes. So we've seen the economy transform. We've seen politics open up. It's now a democracy. We've seen the rise of a middle class there. So these are many good things, but often good things don't attract the immediate attention of policymakers.
I'm going to give you a one-word question, and I want your gut reaction. You ready?
Ready.
NAFTA.
Good for both countries.
Because the immediate reaction a lot of people in this country will have is Ross Perot giant sucking sound in the 92 election.
Exactly. But actually, when you look at the real data, you look what happened, NAFTA has been a benefit to all three countries, Canada included. It has either been an increase in jobs or even the most conservative estimates, basically a wash on jobs. But what we have seen is this. We've seen a quadrupling of trade. So trade today between Mexico and the United States is over $500 billion worth of goods, one of our most vital partners. Every product that comes in from Mexico today, so quote-unquote made in Mexico, on average, 38% of that was actually made in the United States by U.S. workers. And take in comparison, China, Brazil, or even the EU, it's less than 4%. Mexico is a far better partner than those others for us because we really make things together, both U.S. companies, but also U.S. workers with Mexican companies and workers.
So what does the next, 10-ish years in Mexican-American relations look like?
You know, Mexico, in my view, has this potential in the next 10 years to become a top 10 economy, you know, a thriving democracy with a strong middle class, a leading global voice. And all of those things would be good for the United States. It would reduce migration. It would improve border security. It would boost our own economy. Mexico also has the possibility of being consumed by a lot of its challenges, whether it's violence or corruption or economic monopolies. And so, you know, as President Obama heads down to Mexico in a little bit, I really think on the table here, we need to think about how to work in partnership on all of these issues so that Mexico isn't, but also we don't perceive Mexico as so much of a problem.
Shannon O'Neill, she's a senior fellow in Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her new book about Mexican-American relations is called Two Nations, Indivisible. Shannon, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
And now, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 24 points today, almost 0.2%, closed at 14,700 on the nose, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 20 points, 0.6%, finished at 3,289. The S&P 500 climbed 6 points, 0.4%, 1,585, the bell there. Iron ore producer Cliffs Natural Resources scored a 15% gain after turning in a smaller quarterly loss than anticipated. ExxonMobil drained 1.5%. The oil giant reported more profit but less revenue than anybody thought was coming. Dow Chemical rose 5.5% today as low natural gas prices brought down the cost of making plastics. And 3M missed its earnings target and shed 2.75% today. Bond prices were flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note steady at 1.71%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its first estimate for gross domestic product for the first quarter. Was it a whopper of a first quarter for Burger King? The company releases financial results. And tomorrow is National Arbor Day, the tree planting holiday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. We're in a lull right now in the fight over the federal budget, but Congress will get back to it sooner rather than later. It's fundamentally a disagreement over the size of the federal government, not whether to cut spending, but by how much and what to do about the tax code in the process. Commentator Amity Schles reminds us things don't always work out the way Washington thinks they're going to.
No politician ever wanted to shrink government more than Calvin Coolidge. Silent Cal, the quiet Vermonter, was so parsimonious he even saved syllables by using short words. After Coolidge became vice president in 1921, he was appalled to find tax rates as high as 58%. "Legalized larceny," he crowed. And federal debt after World War I was so large it made him cringe. So when Coolidge became president, following the death of Warren G. Harding in 1923, he decided to curb these excesses. Coolidge and his Treasury Secretary, Andrew Mellon, studied the tax code and found the government wasn't getting the revenue it was expecting. Maybe the trouble was the high tax rates. Maybe there was an unexpected lesson for taxes in railroads. Railroad men set their freight rates to charge what the traffic would bear. The thinking was, if you cut the freight rate, you get more traffic and more revenue. Coolidge persuaded Congress to lower the top tax rate to 25% and congratulated himself that he was on track to pay down the national debt. This was, after all, the president who fired the White House housekeeper because she literally spent too much on pork. The tax experiment worked. In fact, too well. With lower tax rates, more money than expected flowed in. But to Coolidge's horror, Congress didn't want to use the cash to reduce the debt. The other politicians of his day just wanted to spend on farm supports, on veterans, on infrastructure. Coolidge worried that later presidents and lawmakers might also manipulate tax rates to get extra money. He left office in a dark mood. He guessed what would come. The legacy of the ultimate small government president was a tax tool so powerful it made big government inevitable.
Amity Schles is the director of the Economic Growth Project at the Bush Presidential Center, which, as it happens, was dedicated today down in Dallas, Texas. Her most recent book is called, wait for it, Coolidge. Let's say your cable goes out and online customer service just isn't doing it for you. So you call them up, an automated voice comes on, you get put on hold, and the next thing you hear is the cheesy hold music. And while you're sitting there in silent frustration, staring at your pitch-black television screen, you begin to wonder where this music came from anyway, and why can't somebody just answer the phone and talk to you? Marketplace's David Weinberg looked into those very questions.
Aaron Kleinhandler was at his 20-year high school reunion recently, and inevitably, he had to answer the same question over and over again.
People ask me what I do, and I say, you ever been put on hold? And the answer is yes. And I say, well, I have a company that provides music for businesses across the country.
Kleinhandler's company, Spectrio, makes about $17 million a year selling on-hold music like this track, titled Power Motivation. Spectrio acts as an intermediary between the businesses that put you on hold and the licensing companies like ASCAP and BMI, which pay musicians to write the music. One of those musicians is Christopher Ho. I visited Ho at his home in California, where he records compositions on a grand piano in his garage.
I probably made over $2 million from my own compositions, but that spans about a 25-year period.
Ho made most of that money selling his songs to Muzak. He also spent those years touring and recording with the Motown legend Smokey Robinson, who was a big influence on Ho's music, even on the pieces he recorded for On Hold. Ho thinks of all of his compositions as being equal.
It's better that way because then I'm not trying to limit the music in any way technically or musically.
But the days of hiring professional studio musicians for On Hold music are pretty much over. Ho's income has dropped dramatically. He had to move to a smaller house, and now he sleeps in his living room so his kids can have a bedroom. Most on-hold music today is made on a computer.
This isn't your mom and dad's on-hold music. It's a world-class library of music.
Julie Cook is the CEO of Easy On Hold, which has a library of digitally recorded music. She says matching the right business with the right on-hold track is more art than science.
An example of really good on-hold music might be a nonprofit that maybe works on world hunger. They may want a more world beat where there's an African flavor.
But does music actually make the experience of being on hold any less frustrating? Scott Bretzman is the president of Customer Care Measurement and Consulting, which asked 702 households to rate their on-hold experiences on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being a deeply unsatisfying experience.
And on that 0 to 10 scale, playing music while you're on hold averages a score of 5.37, in effect, a neutral score. It doesn't really have any impact on satisfaction of consumers while they're waiting on hold.
But silence had a negative impact on customer satisfaction. Having an operator say how long you'll be on hold?
That's the most positive thing you can do. On the 0 to 10 scale, a recording that tells you how long you'll have to wait before you talk to a person averaged a 7.3 rating.
So why then do companies do things that either have no impact or a negative impact on customer satisfaction? Emily Yellen spent years trying to answer that question. She's the author of Your Call Is Not That Important to Us.
There are ways that companies could do a much better job, but it costs too much.
Yellen says that the thing companies do wrong is spend huge amounts of money on things like surveys and focus groups to find out what their customers want.
Meanwhile, they have this department called customer service where customers are calling and trying to tell the company what they think of them, and they're being put on hold, they're being treated poorly, and then customers walk away and they're really frustrated.
According to Yellen, the companies that really get it right never put you on hold for more than 1 minute. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
We went out on Twitter today and asked you what songs you'd be willing to listen to for hold music. We've got a playlist going on our website. It's marketplace.org. The NFL draft starts today. Teams will be picking through fresh talent for the next 3 days or so. More than 200 players are going to be drafted. And what we usually see are big young guys smiling from ear to ear, wearing their new team hats and shaking the commissioner's hand. But what we don't see is the person that, other than the player, maybe might have worked the hardest to get to that point, the player's agent. It's not all glitz and glamour either. Before Andrew Brandt started working for ESPN, he was an agent himself. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
So does this draft day thing bring back memories for you? Do you miss it at all?
It does on both sides of the fence. As you know, I've been an agent, and I've been there on the team side while we watch the board slowly fall away with all the picks coming off. And leading up to it is 7 months of painstaking work with thousands of man hours and millions of dollars going into that process.
Well, let's talk about the agent side of that 7 months for a second. I mean, you know, once a kid gets drafted, that's kind of the culmination of a long process, I imagine, that the agents have been working on with these guys.
The player finishes his eligibility in college, assuming he's a senior or maybe even as a junior, with the bowl game. And then they have to pick an agent. Usually that happens within days, if not hours, from their last football game. And then they're right to pre-combine training, and agents now pick up all those costs.
Well, other than, you know, the top, I don't know what, maybe 10 guys who go in this draft, where do agents make all their money? Because if you've got, you know, pick number 349 in the NFL draft, what are you getting, like $27?
Yeah, I mean, there's 250 players that are getting picked. And if you're drafted, the lowest seventh round pick is probably getting about a $45,000 to $50,000 bonus. So the maximum an agent can charge is 3%, so now you're talking about $150 or something like that.
Yeah.
After, as I said, putting in maybe $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, maybe $20,000 of training expenses into these guys.
You know, so there are all kinds of new rules now about rookies and how much they can get paid and salary caps, in essence, and all that stuff. If I'm a, you know, solid coming out of college football player but don't want to spend 3% of whatever I get, do I even need an agent, really?
There is a player out there, Matt Elam, that's not operating without an agent. Here's my sense. For the actual negotiation, there's very little an agent can do anymore in rookie contracts. What the agent will say is that the pre-combine training, the after-combine training, the run-up to the draft, the intel, the experience, the clout, the names, the connections with general managers, owners, personnel scouts, all those things are part of the fee, even though the actual fee is based on a negotiation.
Let's say Matt Elam, this kid out of Florida who's going through without an agent. Let's say he turns out to have a long and productive NFL career. Could he get by without an agent the whole time?
I would think second contract, he would need an expert to help. Either help or certainly do the contract for him.
And even when you do things right, you can still lose players. I mean, when you were an agent, you lost Ricky Williams, didn't you?
I had Ricky Williams, one of the top picks in the draft, and After chasing him for 2 years, Guy, I mean, wow. He decided to move on to a guy named Master P. He wanted something a football agent couldn't give him, access to the entertainment industry.
Since I brought up Ricky Williams, I'll give you equal time. What's your best memory? What's your favorite part about being an agent?
I'll bring up a guy I had named Matthew Hasselbeck, who was out of Boston College. He wasn't invited to the combine. I had a day tryout, invited all teams in the league. Come see this guy throw it.
Which you paid for, right?
I paid for. One guy named Andy Reid, who was at that time the quarterback coach for the Green Bay Packers, showed up, loved him. And I said, Matt, I don't know if you'll get drafted, but if you do, it's going to be Green Bay. And it was. And he went on to be one of the better quarterbacks in the league and still is. So that's one of the things you love as an agent, to see a guy come out of nowhere and really blossom.
Andrew Brandt, he's been an agent. He's been management in football. He's at ESPN now doing the business of football. Andrew, thanks a bunch.
Pleasure, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the Washington Post reported this morning that the federal government has 13,712 bank accounts with zero balances. When that happens, as we all know from possibly personal experience, you start paying service charges, in this case, $890,000 worth of service charges for Uncle Sam this year. Go figure that one out. All right, that's Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, Kim Bowie, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.